This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Margaret, the United States Senate took a historic vote on Saturday night, allowing the health reform legislation to come to the floor of the Senate for debate. They will be starting the debate after the Thanksgiving recess.
Well, that's something to be thankful for. Senator Reid needed 60 votes to make this happen, and he got his 58 Democrats and the two independents, though not one Republican voted for the motion to proceed. Mark, you went down to Washington and heard the debate. Tell us how this all unfolded.
As I sat in the Senate balcony and listened to the debate, the tone was very personal and intense. The battleground had been drawn, and it was clearly partisan, as the Republicans would not provide any votes. And they used every emotional card they could, laying their position out with Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, who taunted the Democrats. But the Democrats would not be enticed by Republican mantra of just say no. A number of Democratic senators noted they have been saying no to reform for the past 100 years. The time was at hand to stand up and say yes to the health needs of our country. Now is the time to move the question. When the historic vote finally came, Connecticut Senator Chris Dodd was given the honor of presiding as president of the Senate.
It was high drama, just as it was during the weeks leading up to the vote. It wasn't assured that Senator Reid would get those 60 votes that he needed, but late Friday, the two votes in question, Senator Lincoln from Arkansas and Senator Landrieu from Louisiana, agreed to allow debate. Senator Lincoln said, "It's more important that we begin this debate to improve our nation's health care system for all Americans than to just simply drop the issue and walk away." But they were both clear to say this does not mean that they will approve the final bill.
Up to now, the Democrats have had history and timing on their side. With a supermajority in the Senate and House, a president willing to use his political capital on this all-important issue, and a public ready to support health reform.
But new issues continue to arise and complicate the debate. This week, it was a surprise announcement by the United States Preventive Services Task Force, which came out with a set of controversial recommendations on mammography. We'll be discussing those in greater detail later on the show. But in terms of the difficulty of assembling political support for health reform, the new recommendations, along with the very challenging issues like abortion coverage, are cutting away at critical support from both moderates and liberals.
Challenging indeed, and we'll keep our eye on this as the calendar moves forward. The Senate hopes to vote on this bill before the Christmas recess and then goes to the House Senate Conference Committee to reconcile the differences, and then back to both chambers for final action. But it looks like the president's demand that we get all of this accomplished this year will not be in the cards. We are clearly headed to 2010.
And 2010 is right around the corner, Mark. We'll be keeping all of this in focus, no pun intended.
Margaret, I heard from a number of friends who were part of our formation of our local free clinic. They listened to our story on the National Free Clinic Movement. They reminded me that what makes up a movement is the incredible network of volunteers that are needed to be successful.
Yeah, and you really have to take your hat off to the many doctors, nurses, dentists, community activists who get engaged in helping out their neighbors and their neighborhoods.
I know that you've been one of those volunteers here in Connecticut with the Mission of Mercy's Dental Project.
One of hundreds of volunteers, and it made a huge impression on me. You know, we have a statewide dental Mission of Mercy coming up in the spring of 2010 right here in Middletown.
You'll have to let us know more about that as the date gets closer.
And I'll be enlisting you as a volunteer. This week, we're going to take an in-depth look at new guidelines proposed by the United States Preventive Services Task Force and published in the Annals of Internal Medicine. The new recommendations say that most women should wait to start regular breast cancer screening until 50, not 40, and that women between 50 and 74 should have mammograms less frequently. They also say doctors should stop teaching women to examine their breasts on a regular basis, according to the guidelines.
The Preventive Service Task Force recommendation has caused a real stir amongst women, health advocates, and many clinicians. It also is being raised by some as an example of what direction the government might head if health reform is passed. But Margaret, weren't those guidelines done by independent health providers? And in fact, they were all appointed under the last administration.
Mark, you're right on both accounts. Evidence-based care is the bedrock of quality improvement, and primary care providers count on these recommendations based on a scientific review of the evidence. I think all sides of the debate agree that we need independent-minded reviews of the studies to make dispassionate assessments, if such a thing is possible in healthcare, of what gives people the best outcomes. But this one touches the lives of so many families, some of who feel that they're alive today because of early screening.
And one of them is Secretary Kathleen Sebelius. In a release, she said the task force does not set federal policy and they don't determine what services are covered by the federal government. Sebelius added that American women should keep doing what they've been doing for years. Talk to your doctor about your individual history, ask questions, and make decisions that are right for you.
And today we'll be doing just that. We'll be speaking with Dr. Kristen Zarfus, a noted breast surgeon. She is widely recognized as a national advocate for women's rights to quality health care. She spurred a national movement to stop what she called drive-through mastectomies in the 1990s and has continued to be a vocal advocate for women's health.
We'll also do an in-depth background report on the U.S. Preventative Service Task Force.
No matter what the story, you can hear all of our shows on our website, chcradio.com. Download the podcast or get transcripts of our show, and we have some interesting links for you on the folks we interview. And if you have feedback on our show, email us at conversations@chc1.com. We'd love to hear from you.
And we should be letting our listeners know that starting next week, for a two-week period, we'll be participating in our radio station's fun drive from November 30th through Sunday night, December 13th. Our goal is to help raise $20,000 in these 2 weeks directly from our listeners through online donations and call-in pledges. WESU, which hosts this show, is a college radio station based in Middletown, Connecticut. We will be talking to you more about that next week.
I know it seems to me I'm always in the kitchen when these appeals come and have some excuse for just not taking a moment. I'll have to work on an appeal that can motivate our listeners away from the smell of a hot meal after a long day's work.
Maybe we should promise to make dinner for our donors.
Make a pledge and maybe you'll get an invitation.
Now let's go to our background report.
When the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force released its new recommendations on screening for breast cancer last week, it suddenly found itself in the national spotlight. Reactions were swift and harsh from politicians, advocacy groups, breast cancer survivors, and their loved ones. Some commentators said, "This is what we're afraid of with a public option, rationing, denying the right to cancer screening." Others said this was a case of the government meddling into personal health care. But most Americans had never heard of the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force. Who are they? Whom do they work for? What is their charge? And what's the impact of their decisions? It calls itself the leading independent panel of private sector experts in prevention and primary care. The task force conducts rigorous, impartial assessments of scientific evidence for a broad range of clinical preventive services, including screening, counseling, and preventive medication. And its recommendations are considered the gold standard for clinical preventive services. Who sits on the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force? Each member is a private individual with expertise in prevention, evidence-based medicine, and primary care. Task Force members include physicians, nurses, and public health specialists from universities and medical centers all across the United States. The task force recommendations do not tell primary care clinicians what to do, but they do provide clinicians with information about the evidence behind each recommendation that allows clinicians to make decisions themselves. What is unique and perhaps not well understood about the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force is that its goal is not to see a screening test, a counseling measure, or a medication as good or bad, but to review all the evidence, estimate the magnitude of the benefit and the harm for each preventive service, and to issue a recommendation. Those recommendations go from A, strongly recommend, to B, recommend, C, no recommendation for or against, D, recommend against, or I, insufficient evidence to either recommend for or against. And they have an impact. Their recommendations have formed the basis of the clinical standards for many medical quality review groups and professional societies. So why all of a sudden the firestorm? It's a combination of factors. First and foremost, breast cancer is the second cause of cancer deaths in women and thus one of the most feared diagnoses. Virtually all of us know someone or some family that has suffered with and through a diagnosis of breast cancer. Early detection through mammogram screening is widely believed to have led to earlier diagnosis and reduced deaths among women found to have breast cancer. So this week's release strikes at the heart of the fear. Those women may be denied a screening test that might have saved their lives. Second, the release comes at a time when health reform is under consideration and the issue of a public option has become synonymous with government-run health insurance. Politicians and laypeople alike were quick to point out that this kind of rationing was exactly what the country could expect if a government-run public option came into being. But the recommendations themselves, published in the November 17 Annals of Internal Medicine, say something that has not been clearly heard. There are risks to screening as well as benefits, and those risks can be substantial and harmful. Well, what are the harms that could come from starting screening at an earlier age? The task force says there is harm: psychological harm, harm from unnecessary imaging tests and biopsies in women without cancer, fear and inconvenience due to false positive screening results. Also largely unnoticed in the FIRR was their comment on special populations. The recommendation statement does not apply to women over 40 who are at risk for breast cancer by virtue of a known underlying genetic mutation. It went on to say that the precise age at which the benefits justify the potential harms is subjective and should take into account the patient preferences. The task force also identifies further research needs and gaps and say better understanding of certain facets of tumor biology are needed, particularly how does age, race, breast density, and other factors predispose certain women towards tumors with faster growth rates or greater fatality. On Capitol Hill, Representative Debbie Wasserman Schultz, a Florida Democrat who's used her battle with breast cancer to crusade for early detection, and Marsha Blackburn, a Tennessee Republican, tangled on whether the proposed Senate health care reform bill would deny mammograms to women between 40 and 50 years old. Representative Blackburn said it would, with government task forces having the power to reject coverage now available to women. But Ms. Wasserman Schultz accused the Republicans of having politicized breast cancer, contending that the task force recommendations were just that, recommendations and not binding. One thing is for sure. As new research is done and more evidence is analyzed, recommendations change over time. The history of recommendations for breast cancer screening alone shows many shifts and reversals as new scientific information became available. Starting in 1963 with the first large trials of the impact of mammography, and up until last week's announcement, there have been recommendations by the National Institutes of Health, the National Cancer Institute, the American Cancer Society, that went back and forth on the optimum age to start mammogram screening. One thing is for sure, Americans will be hearing more about the U.S. Preventative Services Task Force and its recommendation in the coming weeks.
Today, Conversations on Healthcare welcomes Dr. Kristen Zarfos. Dr. Zarfos is the director of the Comprehensive Breast Health Center at St. Francis Hospital and Medical Center and a nationally recognized advocate for women's health, particularly breast health issues. Dr. Zarfos has received numerous awards for her advocacy work and most notably took a stand against what she termed drive-through mastectomies in the 1990s when managed care organizations sought to limit hospital stays to a day or less for women post-mastectomy. In February 1997, she was introduced and asked to stand by President Bill Clinton during a televised State of the Union address as he acknowledged her work on this issue. She has testified before Congress on breast cancer research and is active surgeon, lecturer, and advocate. Welcome, Dr. Zarfos.
Well, thank you. It's an honor to join you.
Hello, Dr. Zarfos, and thanks for being with us. We've been talking about the work of the United States Preventive Services Task Force, which until recently was a pretty unknown group of experts. But as a doctor and a surgeon, how have you used their recommendations in the past, and have they provided value for you and your patients?
Well, I think that's a good question, Margaret, because they've been around for a while. Some people have think that there's some connection between healthcare reform and the task preventive force, and there really isn't. They have been around for years. A few years ago, they made recommendations that women need not do breast self-examination. As someone who takes care of women with breast problems, that's sort of anathema to me, because we want women to be proactive in their health, whether it's just their breasts looking for changes or skin or any part of their health. But the task force, we should understand what they do. They look at studies, they look at analyses, and how they arrived at why women should not check their breasts was based on a single study out of China, which was a prospective study. So they analyze data based on prospective studies. Those are studies of populations of people that are assigned a task or to not do a task, as opposed to retrospective studies. So not to belabor the self-exam issue, but there are 13 studies that say retrospectively, if women examine their breasts, they might find a change and find a cancer earlier. But the task force really crunches numbers, and it's important to understand in this current issue with on mammography, they're analyzing what studies have been done and superficially looking at the numbers on mammography, at what the benefits and the risks are to women.
Dr. Zarfos, every patient is different, but how do you talk to your patients about whether and when to have screening tests like mammography?
Well, there's excellent data, and even the task preventive force was very clear that women between 40 and 50, there's a 15% decrease in death rate in women between 40 and 50 who have yearly mammograms. So the task force has not said that there's no value at all. They're just saying on a statistical basis, based on computer models, not scientific studies, but computer models, that while mammograms do save lives and have decreased the death rate 3.3% each year in this group of women between 40 and 50 for the last 12 years, that that's, quote, not quite enough to outset all the mammograms that women have that show no cancer.
You know, it seems like a jump from there to say that the big fear is that insurance companies will use the new recommendations to cut costs at the expense of women's health. And wonder what your thoughts are on the history there. Hasn't it been more the case that insurance companies have been forced to pay for services because the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force gives them that type A or B strong recommendation?
Well, yes and no. But I think that also has to be framed in this era where patients are fearful that not only health care reform, but with their own health care coverage, ever increasingly they pay more premiums and have fewer services delivered to them. In the world of MRIs, which are very sophisticated and very expensive studies that all women should not have for their breast, we find that many times insurance carriers will not cover MRIs even when they're really indicated in women who are at increased risk. So if you have that background fear and then new recommendations come out, there is a great deal of fear. Let's also be clear that the task force recommendations are very frequently embraced by primary care physicians. And so patients are fearful that their doctor may embrace these recommendations, whether they are appropriate for each person.
Dr. Serafos, you've made the point that women of different racial and ethnic groups, particularly African American women, are diagnosed later and have worse treatment outcomes than Caucasian women. Tell us about that and how these recommendations might impact that group.
Glad you asked that question, because in looking at this data very carefully, it makes me take pause at the credibility of how they're analyzing the data. And what I mean by that is 35% of Black women develop breast cancer before the age of 50. 35%. Now, if you do the numbers, think of the significant impact on Afro-American women if they're not getting mammograms when 35% of them are diagnosed very young. And you're quite right. Women who are diagnosed with breast cancer who are Black or Afro-American tend to have a higher grade, more aggressive tumor, and even more reason why we should be screening them even younger than 40. And so that's why I have to take pause that, you know, when the task force looked at all the data and I said earlier superficial, and what I mean by that, not in a shallow way from my standpoint, but if they ignored this very glaring number, they perhaps should have qualified that women who are Black or Afro-American should be included in the 40 to 50-year group, or perhaps even younger. So that's why I have to take pause. If this group, the task force's main issue or goal is to analyze data, they miss this piece, which is very, very important.
Well, Dr. Zarfis, you hit it on the head for me when you talked about primary care providers using this data. And when you read the study and the report in the Annals of Internal Medicine, you can't help but think about this whole issue of value-based insurance and the trend to say, let us pay as much as we need to for those things that have high value in healthcare and not pay or pay less of the full amount for things with less value. But it's very hard to change our beliefs, even when the data suggests it. Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I have a good point, again, having to do with looking at a certain amount of data, but not the depth of the data. If they're looking at the overall cost, I really wish in their analysis they would have looked at the whole big picture. If we're saying that it's a, quote, waste, unquote, and that's not a word they use, but a waste of money to screen women between 40 and 50, before you can make that analysis, you have to look quite deeper. You have to look at what if you delay a diagnosis in a woman between 40 and 50, because whether she's Caucasian or Black or of any ethnicity, those cancers in premenopausal women tend to be more aggressive and tend to be found later. And if we're going to do a cost analysis, and I'm talking about a dollars and cents cost analysis, then we need to look at the cost of delaying a diagnosis with all the implications. More surgery, perhaps a woman losing her breast, chemotherapy, radiation, time away from work, time away from children that they're raising, time away from their careers, time away from taking care of their parents, which those women in the 40-year-old group, 40 to 50, are doing. The other thing about value, though, Margaret, is what dollar and cents value can we place on life?
Dr. Sarfost, you've been concerned for a long time with making sure that all women have access to mammogram screenings. Nationally, the federal government has supported this through the Breast and Cervical Cancer Early Detection Program, which covers mammograms for uninsured and underinsured low-income women. Can you tell our listeners about that program, and how do you think that might be affected by the task force recommendations?
Well, Mark, that's a very insightful question. I hope that it doesn't impact the CBC program. The federal program allows for women of a certain economic bracket, if they don't have insurance, to have not only mammogram screening, but a gynecological exam and a pap smear. And this is a very wonderful way that the states and the federal government have collaborated to make sure that underserved women can have access. Please understand, nobody wants health care reform better than I. Nobody wants to see everybody covered, because I've seen too many women die from breast cancer because they didn't know about the CDC program. So I want to see everybody covered. But I also want to make sure that we're able to give men and women the care that they deserve, based on the science, not just willy-nilly or anecdotally. I'm not evidence-based medicine is important to me, but we're going to have to decide, are we going to lose the individual along in a statistical analysis? It may not be an accurate statistical analysis.
So Dr. Sarfost, in a local newspaper, a political cartoonist blog the other day, the only people we should trust for health advice are our doctors. And he said, the very existence of the distinguished panel of experts known as the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force is disturbing. I don't like the sound of it. If this bunch of yo-yos are part of the infrastructure of healthcare reform, then I'll drop my support. But as you know, the people who serve on the task force aren't government employees or bureaucrats. They're almost entirely pretty distinguished expert doctors, nurses, researchers, public health people with strong clinical backgrounds. So what advice would we have for the Preventive Services Task Force about how they communicate their message and the information they provide to those of us in the field who need some guidance on what the recommendations are?
Well, I do think that it would have been beneficial to have at least an oncologist, a radiologist, perhaps a breast surgeon to help give a different perspective on the data, and that was missing. So perhaps the composition of that panel on a particular issue should be rethought with each particular issue that they look at going forward. So one really has to pause and say, why would you not pay for a mammogram? Because if you find a tiny cancer in women in this age group, you may alleviate or prevent the patient at the age of 83 with a large mass and facing not just the financial increased costs, but all the moral and ethical issues if that patient has other health problems or dementia. So there's some big pictures, big sweeps that need to be made. How they crunched the data and did their computer models to decide how to take care of people.
Dr. Sarfost, thank you for being with us today.
Thanks, Dr. Sarfost.
Thank you very much.
Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. As we get ready to celebrate Thanksgiving, we give thanks for our health and the health of those we love. If there's one thing we can do as individuals, communities, in a nation to improve health, is to end tobacco dependency in our country. This week's Bright Idea is about one element in the comprehensive strategy to help people quit smoking and tobacco use. Quitlines are the fastest-growing smoking cessation tool in the nation. Quitlines are telephone-based tobacco cessation services that are proven to have real-world effectiveness in helping smokers quit. Services offered by Quitline include coaching and counseling, referrals, mailed material, web-based services, and in some instances, free medication such as nicotine replacement therapy. Free public Quitlines exist in all 50 states. 1-800-784-8669. In our home state of Connecticut, the Quitline is supported by the Department of Public Health. Callers can phone the Quitline 7 days a week, almost 24 hours a day. Callers who are ready to quit smoking and are interested in further telephone-based services will receive up to 5 telephone counseling sessions. Written materials are also sent to callers based on their readiness to quit. I called the 800-QUIT line. I was immediately offered help in English or Spanish. I spoke with Ivy, a QUIT line counselor, and told her about conversations on healthcare and bright ideas, and asked if she had any message for our listeners. The QUIT line is working for a lot of people, she said. We're helping people every day. This Thanksgiving, if you or someone at your holiday feast is a smoker, think about a new and hopefully one-time tradition. Before you dig into that Thanksgiving dinner, call the QUIT line. Here's that number again, 1-800-784-8669. Now that's a bright idea.
This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Margaret Flinter.
And I'm Mark Maselli. Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare, broadcast from the campus of Wesleyan University at WESU, streaming live at WESUFM.org, and brought to you by the Community Health Center.